Expert HR Weekly, compliance, good practice and benchmarking for UK HR professionals.
Hello and welcome to Expert HR Weekly with me, Jayatha Richalvam. We often dish out advice on the podcast on how to avoid getting hauled before an employment tribunal by a dissatisfied employee. But what happens if it's too late for all of that and you already have an employment tribunal hearing looming? Well, don't despair just yet, because today we're going to be dispensing some practical guidance on how to prepare for a tribunal hearing, as well as telling you about the pitfalls that you should most definitely avoid. And who better to take us on this journey than Max Winthrop, who is a partner and the head of employment at Shaw Richardson and Forth LLP, the updating author of various sections of the Employment Law Manual, including the section dealing with tribunal practice, and most importantly, someone who regularly represents his clients in the Employment Tribunal and on occasion in the Employment Appeal Tribunal. Hi, Max. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Right, so witness statements and witnesses. Witnesses are obviously key to the whole process, so it's important to make sure they're actually available to attend the hearing, isn't it?
Oh, very much so, yes. I suppose approaching the big day, things of course start a little bit before that, and it's usual nowadays for witness statements to be exchanged about 2 weeks before the tribunal. But that doesn't mean that once they've been exchanged, you can just simply forget about them. And I think it's really important to get your witnesses to go through, perhaps the night before the tribunal, a final reread of that statement, because it's their words that the tribunal want to hear, not somebody else's words. And it's funny how little odd errors can creep in. And, the witness has got to be confident with that. He's got to understand how that evidence comes over.
So that evidence will be gone through potentially with a fine tooth comb by the opponent's lawyers. So as you say, it is really critical that the witness is comfortable with absolutely every word in that statement.
Very much so. Don't forget that nowadays, witness statements are usually taken as read. Now, what that means is that the tribunal may start out with the tribunal reading the statements, but not necessarily in open court. It's no longer the case that the witness will read out that statement first of all. Now, that means that the witness has almost comes in cold when cross-examination starts. So they have to be very kind of confident with the wording and how it's all been put together.
So it may well be that the opponent's lawyers takes out phrases from the witness statement and repeats it back to the witness. And so, as you say, that's critical, isn't it?
Very much so. Don't forget that there may be a professional advocate opposing you. The job of that advocate is to test that evidence. And any weakness in that is going to be exploited.
So the bundle of documents which the tribunal and the opponents and the witness and you will refer to during the course of the hearing, tell us a little bit about that and its significance.
Yes, again, critical, because that's where all the documentation that forms the background of the case is kind of put together. Now, it's funny, we use this word, I don't know where it came from. It probably goes back to the 19th century. Lawyers kind of talk about it all the time, but it can cause a little bit of a confusion. Really, all it is a set of the documents, and it starts from, for example, it might start with a written statement of the terms of employment, and then in a dismissal case might progress through investigation notes, disciplinary hearing, dismissal letters, the internal appeal process. It has to be put together in a cogent sort of way. There's no right and wrong way to do it, but broadly speaking, you'd normally expect to see it produced chronologically, starting with the earliest document and then working through to the end, just like any other book. It'll be paginated, and that's important because the witness statement should cross-refer to any document in the bundle, and you've got to be kind of happy with the pagination. The witness has got to know where to find the documents. You don't want to have a situation where one witness suddenly can't remember where the letter is that refers to the invitation to a disciplinary hearing, for example, and then spends half an hour trying to find it.
So often a lawyer who is cross-examining a witness, or even examining a witness, may well ask that witness to go to a particular document in the bundle. So, for example, a letter of dismissal. And it is, like you say, important that the tribunal can get to that page quickly.
Yes, very much so. And again, I suppose, if you refer to something in your witness evidence, then it's going to be a good idea that you're familiar with the document that you're talking about. So if you're the investigating officer, you're going to need to know how your notes have been put together, and you're going to have to feel comfortable about explaining anything within those notes, because it's going to be in front of the tribunal. If the opposing advocate doesn't ask you questions about it, you can expect a few from the employment judge.
So a failure to be able to answer those kinds of questions, which were in the remit of the witness's job function, could be quite damaging to their credibility.
It could be. I don't forget, of course, that the witness isn't there to kind of have an answer for everything. And a witness should never be afraid of saying, I just don't know. But at the same time, one would expect, for example, an HR professional who's conducted a disciplinary hearing to know the sort of witnesses that were interviewed and, of course, fundamentally, to know about a company's own disciplinary process.
That is a really important point, though, is to not feel under pressure to actually make up an answer start speculating
yes.
about things.
Just enlarging that a little bit more. Speculation by the witness can be very, very damaging. Sometimes a witness almost feels that they're expected to give an explanation or an answer. That's not necessarily the case. And sometimes, of course, it has to be said that the advocate may well be fishing. And often, if you let a witness run on, you'll find that that witness will say something hugely incriminating that a simple answer might never have got round to. I think also just something else to remember, and a little extra knowledge, one of the things it's useful just to bone up on before the tribunal are things like, if this is a dismissal case, the ACAS code. It's a short document, it's kind of fundamental to fair dismissals, but it's easy to forget about that particular document. So if you haven't read it for a few months or possibly even longer, have a read of that. If it's a disability case, think about things like the guidance notes on the definition of disability.
And I suppose the same can be said of the company's internal documents, so the company's disciplinary procedure, the company's equal opportunities policy. So if the employer is trying to hold itself out as not having discriminated, it's important that they can
very much so. Because nothing looks worse than if you're asked questions about, for example, an equal opportunities policy and you don't know the answer, where you've said, well, we don't discriminate, or that we always take particular steps in certain circumstances, and then you're taken back to your own policy only to find that you've really ignored it. So again, very important that you're happy and comfortable with your own internal documentation.
And I suppose following on from that, it's important that key witnesses do actually know and understand the salient legal and factual issues of their case and the other side's case, isn't it?
Yes, and to an extent, of course, the lawyer will have chosen those witnesses for that very reason. He's not going to call somebody that's got no part to play in the story. So some of that work's been done for you by the time you get there. And it will depend on the type of evidence that you're giving. So if we kind of move on from there, that's the preparation side. But what's it really like to kind of give evidence? Now, I've said that witness statements will be taken as read. So you're not going to explain anything until you come to that point when you get cross-examined. And we've talked about the need to give sort of straightforward open answers there. There's a process called re-examination, which is where your own lawyers will take you back over the evidence if they feel there's something that needs a little bit of extra explanation there.
Just to point out the obvious, the cross-examination is done by the opponent's lawyer.
That's
right.
And
the re-examination,
yes,
as you said, is done by your own lawyer.
And in the tribunal, of course, there'll often be quite a lot of questions from the tribunal itself. Now, increasingly, in ordinary dismissal cases, that's just an employment judge on his own. In discrimination cases, there'll be non-legal members. And sometimes I find that it's the non-legal members that ask the really interesting or difficult questions. Now, one thing to remember might seem strange, but we don't actually have any form of electronic recording in the employment tribunal, so that the evidence has to be recorded by the employment judge. He or she will be taking a longhand note. And one of the things to kind of watch out for is how quickly your judge is writing that down, because there's no point in giving an answer so fast that the poor judge can't get a good note of that. And there's another practice point here. When you get into the tribunal, rather than kind of end up arguing with the person who's cross-examining you, it's much better practice to look at the judge and deliver your answer to that person so they can kind of assess you and your credibility.
And that is actually one of the main purposes, isn't it, of the witness process, so that the tribunal can assess the credibility and how believable somebody is and what they're saying.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, don't forget, I suppose, how really the tribunal is a court of law in all but name. And it's just as important to remember that the tribunal is trying to get at what it needs to know, and that will often be the truth. Don't forget that some of the questions that might emanate from the tribunal, they're not necessarily trying to find out what happened on a particular occasion. They're looking at whether or not, for example, an employer had reasonable grounds for the belief in something happening. So there's a slight difference there between some other courts, but I think you have to go in expecting a degree of formality with the tribunal and that process.
So just staying with the witness evidence process at the moment, so presumably it starts in a similar way to other courts, so
yes,
with an oath or...
And one of the things that will have been, one would hope will be worked out for you before you get to the tribunal, is what you might call the batting order. Who goes first? Now, for example, in an ordinary unfair dismissal claim, the employer will go first because the employer has got to show the reason for the dismissal. And there's a logical way of calling the witnesses. So the investigating officer, if he or she is going to give evidence, will usually be called first, then the person who decided on the dismissal, and then if there was anybody involved in the appeal process. So you've got that nice, straightforward chronology.
There's two orders there to think about. The order in terms of whether it's the employee or the employer,
yes.
And also in terms of a logical order, as you say, for the witnesses of each side.
That's correct. Now, when we get outside of the straightforward unfair dismissal claim, things begin to get a little bit more interesting. So, that, for example, if there was a constructive dismissal claim, then the burden of proof is on the employee. And the employee would go first and call all their evidence. Sometimes if it's a discrimination case, there may be, for example, the employee's status as a disabled person may be challenged. And again, the employee in those circumstances would go first. And that can be important, really, just, I suppose, from organising your witnesses, when anybody is expected to arrive at the tribunal and so on. Again, basics here. Where is the tribunal? Don't forget now that increasingly the tribunal service is using some of the buildings that would otherwise be used as magistrates' courts. Although since fees came in, the kind of overcrowding, so to speak, in the tribunal has changed. You'll often find that sometimes at the last minute, the venue can be changed. If the normal tribunal hearing centre is too busy, you may be moved to a nearby court, but
that's
make sure your witnesses know where it is.
That's critical, isn't it, that you don't have various people going to different parts,
yes,
different buildings. So if I'm a witness for an employer in a particular case and I arrive at the tribunal, the correct tribunal and venue, what's the first thing that I do?
Well, probably you'll check in. The reason I say probably is it varies from place to place, but broadly now, most tribunals are kind of adopting a degree of formality in that check-in process. So there'll be a reception and a clerk available to sort of see which case you're attending. Sometimes now, if the tribunal venue is in a county court or a magistrate's court, there may be a security check. And now, if there is, you need to allow a little bit of extra time because you're going to have to take all the metal things out of your pockets and this sort of thing to get through that security.
And this is important, isn't it? Because you don't want to arrive late and sort of stressed. And
yeah. I mean, I have to say, I think nowadays, I don't know whether it's because I'm getting older, but it always seems to me that the tribunal judges are a pretty courteous lot. But you don't want to kind of put yourself under any pressure by leaving too little time to arrive. Arrive in good time so you can get yourself sorted out, find where things are, have a coffee or whatever. Don't leave it till the last minute.
And it might be that actually, if you are represented in terms of the hearing, that whilst you have had an ongoing relationship with your solicitor, if that solicitor has instructed a barrister to represent you for the purposes of that hearing, that you might not actually meet them until the day of the tribunal hearing.
That's certainly possible, especially, I suppose, in a very straightforward unfair dismissal claim. If it was something more complicated, you'd probably expect more in the way of pre-trial meetings to take place. So there can be occasions when, if it's a simple case, you might not meet your representative until the day itself. Again, if that's going to be the case, you'll need to allow extra time just so that you can familiarise yourselves with each other and your kind of what you're expected to do.
But the solicitor will, of course, your solicitor will, of course, have sent a brief of papers and briefed the barrister that will be acting for you. So once I've checked in, where do I go then?
Right, now, usually in most hearing centres, there will be separate waiting rooms for respondents and for the claimant. So it means there's no kind of embarrassing eyeballing of each other over a room. Again, when I started, remembering the old tribunal for London South at Ebury Bridge Road, there was just one large room with everybody milling round in it. But nowadays, the general trend is to keep the parties separate until the hearing starts.
And so hearings are generally due to start at 10 a.m, aren't they? And then you sort of might have to have a bit of a wait.
That's right. Now, it's funny enough, one of the things that sometimes employers find strange is that it's such a short day on paper. The reality is that once you start giving evidence, you will realise that it's quite a stressful process in itself, it can be. And even within that 10 till 4:30 sort of day, it will seem quite a long day. There's sometimes a little variation. Occasionally, tribunals will arrange to start before 10. At other times, it's just possible that the tribunal may, for example, have some short application from another case heard beforehand. You just have to take that as it comes, I think.
OK, so the clerk has come to collect me and my party and told us which tribunal hearing room we're going to. So once I make my way to that room, what can I then see?
When you're called into that room, the usual layout is for a bench at one end of the room where there will be, although most unfair dismissal claims now judge alone, they're still set up for a three-person panel. So there'll be employment judge in the middle, facilities for the non-legal members if they're coming along. Then there'll be sort of another set of tables for the party's representatives.
And they will be facing?
Facing the tribunal. And then usually a couple of extra tables, sort of almost at right angles, and they'll be for the witnesses. So when you come to give your evidence, you'll be asked whether or not you want to give that evidence on oath or make an affirmation, and you'll give your evidence there. So you're sort of between the representatives and the tribunal. So back to that early point that I made, good practice, when you're delivering your evidence, you look at the person in the middle, the employment judge, and you give your answer to him or her.
And it's easy not to do that because you'll be looking in a different direction to the person who's actually asking you
Absolutely.
Questions.
Absolutely. And of course, you're having points put, your evidence is being tested, and there's that tendency to kind of not just answer the question, but answer back. And that's, I think, a tendency to be resisted. Don't try and look too clever.
And I suppose it's also worth flagging up that the witness does sit at an ordinary table on an ordinary chair, so it's not like, for example, a Crown Court where you're sort of in a dock, and if that's what people are expecting.
Very much so. So you give your evidence seated. Nowadays, it's customary to give that evidence by asking the witness to make an affirmation. They will have a set of religious books, but generally the sort of default position now is for an affirmation rather than a religious oath. Obviously, in multi-ethnic societies now, it's difficult to provide for oaths. There are various people that, for particular reasons, may not have a religious belief, or their religious belief may prevent them from swearing particular oaths.
What about the issue of cameras in the tribunal hearing room? Because there are some court proceedings which are televised. Where's the tribunal sort of fit in with that?
Well, at the moment, and I suspect it'll be quite some time before any of the first instance courts are televised. As far as I'm aware, there's no plans at this stage for any form of electronic recording, whether that's through tape recording of the process or through televising tribunals. Don't forget, of course, that it's a court. It's open to the public. There are lawyers called Article 6 rights about fair and open justice, and it's important that the tribunal is available for the public to come in and watch, should they wish to do so. Some practical points as well about electronic communication. Don't forget to switch your mobile phone off. Nothing can be more embarrassing than in the middle of your evidence or your closing submission, suddenly the phone goes off. It's easy to forget. I've even been in tribunals where the employment judge's mobile phone has gone off from time to time. I think I've even answered it once or twice, but anyway, that's another story. But you know, practical tip, make sure that phone is off.
So you say that it's open to the public, so while cameras aren't in there at the moment, it is possible to get the occasional reporter in there, presumably.
Very much so. Now, I think you're, generally speaking, tribunals, unless there's something particularly notorious going on, don't tend to get the press coverage that the criminal courts do. But every so now and then, I'm sure we've all seen the sort of celebrity employment case that's involved someone famous, or alternatively, there are cases of significance. We've, I'm sure, all been watching and listening to the various developments on holiday pay issues lately. And that's the sort of case that will attract attention and where you may get lots of interested parties coming in. Occasionally as well, there may be students or trainee judges and such like coming in to hear the case. But I think you have to factor in the fact that this is a public hearing. Now, of course, the tribunal does have powers in certain circumstances to hear cases in private, and it also has powers to restrict reporting in those cases. But the tribunal will only exercise those powers where there's a very clear case to do so. And it won't do so simply on the footing that, for example, you'd really rather not have the public hear what's going on in a particular case. Got to be a reason for it.
Okay, so I'm still in my witness role. So I've given my affirmation and my witness statement is evidence in chief. So that's all been done. I'm starting to now be cross-examined. Now, sometimes the cross-examination process can seem quite artificial because it's not just about testing my evidence, is it? It's also about the opponent putting their case. So it's people get a little bit confused because even if you're simply saying no to everything that the lawyer is saying, they will still continue.
They
so
will.
Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, as you say, it's very important to realise that if you've got a case, it's got to be put to the witness. So that if the witness in an unfair dismissal claim is trying to argue that the dismissal was unfair because of a lack of investigation, then all those points about the investigation have got to be put to you. Now, inevitably, I think most of the answers are going to be, no, that wasn't how it was sort of thing. And that's how you should respond. I mentioned earlier the danger of going on too long. Keep it simple is a kind of good motto when you're giving that evidence. And remember that if you are, you know, if you do unfortunately put your foot in it in any way or whatever, then it's the job of your representatives to come and offer you a ladder in re-examination. But I think it's also important to remember that the witness is on their own in the witness box. Nothing looks worse than if there's a kind of a supporting team behind trying to mouth answers or explain some point when it's not their turn, so to speak.
So you said it was open to the public, so presumably all the other witnesses who are on the employer's, who are sort of representing the employer, can also be in the hearing room at the same time.
Yes, that's correct. Now, I should point out there's an important difference between the process in England and Wales and the process in Scotland. And what I've said so far is all about the English and Welsh process. If we were looking at the Scottish process, then exchange of witness statements prior to the tribunal doesn't happen. There's no prepared statements and evidence is given by your own team asking you questions. Equally, in Scotland, witnesses are kept out until they give evidence. But the practice in England and Wales, the default position is that everybody's always in the tribunal. Now, the tribunal has case management powers. And if there was some very contentious issue where, for whatever reason, it was alleged that witnesses were colluding, it would be possible to make an application to the tribunal to have a particular witness excluded until they gave their own evidence. That's very unusual. I've never come across it in any of my cases, but it is a theoretical possibility, I suppose.
Actually, just staying with witnesses for the moment. So we've sort of proceeded on the basis that all of our witnesses would be happy to give evidence and to appear at the tribunal hearing. But what happens if you want to, for example, rely on someone's evidence who's no longer in the employment of the company, etc.? What are your options there?
I suppose the best way of dealing with that is cooperation. And you'll often find that if somebody's leaving a company, providing they're doing so on good terms, they'll agree to cooperate. Occasionally, you even see specific provisions about cooperation after employment has ended in the contract of employment or sometimes in settlement agreements. But if the witness is unwilling, then it's always possible to get a witness order compelling their attendance. There's a problem with that, though. One, you've got an unwilling witness coming to the tribunal, and how are you going to deal with the problem of preparing witness evidence for that particular individual if they're simply not going to cooperate with you?
I suppose there is some uncertainty about what they're actually going to say.
Yes, and really, it's not a good idea to call the witness, and you don't know what's going to fall from their lips when you stick them in the witness box.
Okay, so I'm now in the process of being re-examined by my lawyer, but lunchtime is approaching, so what happens there?
Well, don't forget, now, you'd be giving your evidence on oath, and if there's an adjournment, you'll be told by the employment judge, if not by your own team, that you can't discuss the case while you're giving your evidence. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're kind of going to be a pariah over the lunch break. You can discuss whatever you normally discuss with people, except what's off limits is the case. So you can't, you know, ask things like, how is my evidence going? What should I have said? All those sorts of things. Too late for that. If you're worried that you can't kind of keep off the subject of the case, then have a little walk in the lunchtime adjournment and don't discuss it at all. Can sometimes be more problematic, of course, if there's a longer adjournment, if something that's not been foreseen crops up, or the case is taking longer than the parties anticipated, and your evidence finishes at the end of the day, but then the tribunal has to postpone and come back in 3, 4, 5, or 6 weeks.
And so what happens there? It's presumably exactly the same.
It's exactly the same. It's very unfortunate. Tribunals don't like that happening and will try and structure the day to avoid it happening, but sometimes those things can't be avoided.
So what happens then when all of your witnesses have given all of their evidence? That's sort of what's the next part of the process?
Right, well, depending on the case, again, if we go back to our example of the ordinary unfair dismissal, the employer's evidence will have been called, gone through the evidence and re-examination. Well, now it's the claimant's turn. So the claimant, usually in an unfair dismissal case, you'll only have the claimant. Sometimes the claimant will call other witnesses too. But the process is then repeated. Now, again, cross-examination is something that needs careful preparation. We mentioned earlier about how you need to put the case for the opposing party in cross-examination, and it's likely all that will have been prepared long before the actual hearing. So if you're a witness, you'll have been asked to comment on the evidence that the claimant is going to give, because there'll have been that exchange of witness statements and a careful set of questions will have been prepared. Of course, the problem with that is that you never quite know what somebody's going to say. And however careful you are in your preparation, one of the kind of arts of the advocate is to be able to anticipate or to kind of forget the script and follow through on a particular line of questioning. Now, one of the difficult things when a claimant's being cross-examined and you've been actively involved in some process is to actually keep quiet about what's going on. You'll suddenly want to put, oh, well, no, it wasn't quite like that or whatever. Now, it may well be that your representative knows it wasn't like that and is coming to that point. But again, it's sometimes possible that your representative has forgotten some vital detail or whatever. Now, I always tell my clients the best thing to do is to write a note and then pass it on. Don't try and kind of whisper in people's ears and all the rest of it, because the message might be misunderstood, or while you're whispering in someone's ear, he's not then going to be able to pay attention to the evidence that the witness is giving and so on and so forth. So a very useful thing to arm yourself with is either a set of big post-its that you can write on or a notebook that you can pass over to your advocate.
And I suppose equally it's important not to be sort of tittering, isn't it, sort of when you're listening to the claimant give their evidence. So.
Yes, I think as much as it may be hard, no groans, no strange facial expressions, no burying your head in your hands and things. It's odd because when you're appearing for someone in the tribunal, you're concentrating on the witness, you're concentrating on the employment judge, and you can't see what's going on behind you half the time. And sometimes at the lunchtime adjournment, my clients might say, well, did you see what the claimant was doing when questions were being asked from that witness and all these sorts of things? But of course, the person that can see it is the employment judge, and it will make a poor impression. Now, I suppose, so we're going through that evidence, the cross-examination is going well. When that's all concluded, then, that's the evidential part of the case, and then you move on to the submission side.
And the evidential part is usually the longest part by far, isn't it?
Very much so. Even allowing for witnesses to be taken as read, it's surprising how long cross-examination can sometimes take. Sometimes it can be quick. Sometimes there may be little factual dispute, but the case is all about a point of law. At other times, it's really all about the facts. Who did what and when is the kind of crucial issue. And once that's over, which way the judge is going to jump is probably going to be fairly clear.
That's really about whose evidence does the employment judge prefer. Because they were obviously never in the room where the person was dismissed, etc. So they have to make an educated guess
based
on the evidence.
Yes. The tribunal is applying the civil standard of proof where appropriate. That's on the balance of probabilities. So more probable than not that X is telling the truth and Y isn't. So that's only 51%. If you look at it, I suppose, in sort of pure number terms. And after all that evidence has been given, then it's the opportunity for the representatives to make closing speeches as to how they want the judge to approach the particular problem.
Okay, that concludes our visit to the Employment Tribunal for today. But do join us next week, where Max will be taking us through the rest of our journey. He'll be taking us through closing submissions, remedies, so how much might you be required to pay out and how you can minimise that payment, the tribunal actually delivering its judgment, costs, and can you recover your costs, and also what lessons can you learn, either from your resounding victory or your depressing defeat.
Expert HR Weekly. Compliance, good practice and benchmarking for UK HR professionals.